Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief, as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, griefsters. I hope you're having an okay week. I'm all right. My daughter's decided to stop sleeping. So I haven't really slept properly for 14 days straight. And let me tell you, that will make you a little bit snappy. So apart from that, I'm fine. Just so you know, I told you last week, I'll tell you again, we have a Griefcast Live coming up as part of the Underbelly Festival on June the 6th. A very exciting lineup. We have Jeff Lloyd from the Adrift podcast and Reason to be Cheerful. Camille Youcan from the Birthday Girls podcast will be joining us, and the amazing stand-up Josie Long. Do head to the Underbelly Festival for tickets, or check the at the Griefcast Twitter as well, where I'll be tweeting about tickets. We would love you to join us for more cheery chats about death. This week's guest is actor, writer and fashion journalist Rosa Hoskins. Rosa is an incredible person. She's written for a variety of publications like Grazia and Star magazine. She is a mental health advocate, and she's also written a book. The book is called It's All Going Wonderfully Well, Growing Up with Bob Hoskins. And Rosa came in to talk to me about her dad, the actor Bob Hoskins, who died 5 years ago. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with actor, writer and blogger Rosa Hoskins. Hello.
Hi.
I follow you on Instagram, as I do a lot of people. Sorry, that sounded like, not that you're special, but you are special. And you do something on Instagram I want to talk about, where one of your hashtags is mental health maven.
Mm.
And I love it so much, but I wanted to ask you, like, what's that about?
So,
that's a big question to jump into.
Yeah. No, it's good. It's a good question to jump into. So I started my blog a few years ago, and I was primarily focused on fashion because I, going back like slightly further, I was a jobbing actor, and one day I was like, I have to find a day job that doesn't break my soul. There has to be something that I can do that I'm going to be good at and that I can enjoy.
Yeah.
So I decided to try personal styling.
Yeah.
And that led me weirdly into writing.
Yeah.
So I was working for a personal styling company.
Oh, I see.
And we needed content for the website. And then I left that company and I worked for a magazine. And then I left to start writing on my own, primarily because my dad was really sick.
Yeah.
And kind of writing about fashion during that time was actually quite nice because it was a bit of a break.
Yeah, yeah.
But I found just after my dad, well, the day after my dad died, I put out this blog post called 11 Lessons from My Dad, which kind of in turn got me the book deal to write about dad. And after writing the book, I found that, I mean, I still write about fashion and I still love it to a certain extent, but it kind of wasn't enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wanted to, what I noticed about the book and the feedback that I had and when people got in touch was that they found a lot of solace and a lot of comfort in hearing about my experience, very much like what you're doing here with this podcast, you know. It's people are comforted and reassured when they realize that they're not alone. So when it came, when I came back to writing the blog after writing the book, just kind of focusing on fashion sort of felt a bit hollow. And particularly after I had my son as well, I was like, no, I've got something more meaningful to offer.
Yeah, it's hard to sometimes go back to like frilly, which I don't mean frilly as an insult, I just mean like when your head has been somewhere else, it's really hard to write light and fluffy because you're like, oh, I've just sort of talked about the pointlessness and existence of life and death and why we're all here. I can't go, you know what goes well with flare jeans?
Yeah, exactly. 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 No, well, and also I wrote, you know, after dad died, I had pretty bad post-traumatic stress and I wrote a lot about that, and I just thought, no, I've got more to say, I've got more to offer than just I say just fashion, that's kind of belittling it, but I can add to that. And I have bipolar 2 with rapid cycling. It's really fun, and I decided that I was going to talk about that openly. I was really nervous about doing it, but when I did, I found that people responded really beautifully and got in touch and said, oh God, yes, I've got that. And what medication are you on? And, you know, how do I go about finding a decent doctor? And it kind of snowballed from there. And so I guess the hashtag Mental Health Maven is sort of an amalgamation of the stuff that I write about mental health, but also the stuff about fashion, because people often refer to women who work in fashion as like a fashion maven.
And I love it. It's got such a nice ring about it. And it feels very, like, such a bandied about word now, but it feels very empowering and nice. And it doesn't, because so much stuff when you see like hashtag mental health, you're like,
oh, God.
So depressing.
Exactly.
Or just like a meme of statistics and you're like, oh God.
It's really boring.
It's so sad.
It is. But it's sort of, again, it's sort of similar to what you're doing with this. It's like when you become very open about a particular topic, you then sort of feel like, in my case, probably wrongly, but I kind of feel like I'm the go-to person. You know, and I do feel that by sort of sharing those experiences and just being open about it, it's actually, it's not only useful for other people, but actually it's really useful for me. It's really, really useful because it takes so much pressure off just to say, like, yeah, I've got bipolar. It's, you know, it's fine.
It's fine. And also I think you, it does allow you to have humour with it, because the more you own it, the more it becomes less scary and less like, oh my God, it's a thing that happened, I don't want to, oh, someone might ask me about it. You know, that tension where you're just like, oh, I'm very, like now I feel very comfortable, obviously, talking about what happened to me. And so you sort of move through to this other stage, which I think you when you're scared of it, you never think there's anything past that. You think, oh, I just, it's just this awful thing and I don't want to talk about it. And then you talk about it so much, it's like this whole new world. You're like, oh, I'm sort of immune, numb about talking about it.
And also you're kind of, you're, like you say, you own it. You're in control of it, not the other way around. And I think definitely with mental health, and I with grief as well, you often don't feel like you're in control.
No, not at all.
And don't feel that you're kind of a victim to it. But if you can just own it and be okay with it, it changes it so massively. And you know, secrets are usually pretty toxic. And I mean, when I used to feel very ashamed of it, my husband would say, look, I've got asthma.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and I have to take medication for it every day. But I don't go around going, oh, God, I'm asthmatic. And yeah. everyone's going to know that I'm taking these drugs. And it's like, no, like there's nothing wrong with it and there's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah, it's just what it is, isn't it? And it's just the age that we live in. I mean, thank God we do live in the age that we do live in, because for all its faults and madnesses, we are at a time where you can say, I'm bipolar, and it's not like
and it's not
the police are going to come in and arrest you immediately. It's like,
it's just not a thing. And I mean, the reason why I still talk about it and the reason why I still mention it all the time is because there's still ignorance around it, and there's still people don't understand. And I mean, one of the things that I think is most misunderstood is medication.
Yeah.
So people will kind of, like, good friends of mine who don't mean, you know, they don't mean anything by it, but they're like, oh, you're still on those meds. I'm like, yep, they keep me alive.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Mm. Yeah. I'll be taking them.
Yeah, I will be taking them, you know, like for the foreseeable future.
Yeah,
perpetuity.
So, I mean, you've mentioned him already, but who are we remembering today?
Today we're remembering my dad, who was the actor Bob Hoskins.
Bob Hoskins. Incredible man who, and this is a very unusual situation, I guess, because you must be in a position where normally when someone says it, like, only the people who knew that person remember, but you're in a position where a lot of people know, inverted commas, your dad.
Yes.
Or feel they know him, because obviously, like, grew up watching him, feel a warmth to him instantly of like, oh, he was so great. Mm. So, yeah, that must be a strange... Is that hard to have that instant reaction of like...
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I think it was hard... I don't know. It, in some ways, it's hard. In some ways, it's really comforting.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think, especially for people of our sort of generation, they remember Dad from their childhood. From like films like Hook and Roger Rabbit. And those sort of films really stick with people.
Yeah, I mean, I watched Roger Rabbit a thousand times. You know, when you got the VHS player,
it was
you just watched it again and again and again. It still blows my mind. I remember the first time I was like, there's cartoons and real people. Like,
say
that
what?
Was just like, this film is already winning anyway, and then it's very funny.
God,
what an absolute classic. Yeah, because Amy Hoggart came on to talk about her dad, and she was saying a similar thing of like, it's just a different position, and I guess a slightly rarer position to be in. But I get, like all things, it has its ups and its downs, doesn't it? So how old were you when your dad died?
So I was 30.
30, okay.
When dad died.
So how many years are you?
It'll be 5 years this April.
Out wanting to age you. I'm very sorry. As an actor, I know that's...
No, it's cool. I'm 35. I'm all right with that.
So it's 5 years ago. So yeah, it's still pretty recent, we think, in the Griefcast world.
Yeah.
I know the rest of the world is like, it was 5 years ago. But yeah, this is... And what happened, like... What happened? How did he die?
So, he was diagnosed with... Initially, he was diagnosed with an illness called Lewy body.
Right, okay.
Which kind of comes under the Parkinson's umbrella.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realise before Dad was diagnosed, like, Parkinson's is only one strain
of
many, many, many illnesses that kind of is a bit like having cancer.
Yeah, they don't quite know.
There are like lots and lots and lots of different permutations to it. So he... God, I'm starting to sort of tear up already.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right, yeah.
So, yeah, so he was initially diagnosed with Lewy body in 2011. And I think he had been starting to show symptoms in like 2006, 2007.
Right, yeah.
I think he was starting to forget things and get lost.
Wow.
Like, he would go to the theatre and he'd go to the loo and he'd get lost.
Yeah.
We'd get lost in like a car park or something.
Yeah.
And it was just little things like that.
Enough to be brushed away as well, isn't it? Like, I couldn't remember where we came in from.
And he would sort of... I felt terribly guilty about it afterwards, but I'd tell him something. And then, like, the next day, he'd be like, oh, what are you going to do about that? And I'm like, Dad, we had this conversation yesterday. Like, really? You're not listening? And he absolutely was. He was doing his best.
Yeah.
He was really listening. But he everything was kind of starting to go. Mm. And I got married in 2010. And Dad was like he was the most confident person I've ever met. He just didn't give a shit. He was so, he had complete faith in his ability. Mm. And it wasn't arrogance. It was just like, I can do this. I can do this.
Amazing. Yeah. It's so amazing as an actor as well.
Yeah. No, he was like, I can do this. And I think as an actor, it kind of made him very much like in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he didn't have that voice going, no, you're fucking this up.
Yeah.
You know, he had this very grounded sort of confidence. But on my wedding day, he was really nervous. Mm. He was really nervous, like really anxious. And so much so his little hands were shaking. Oh. And I was like, Dad, what's wrong? And he was like, oh, I don't want to let you down. I don't want to let you down. I was like, how are you going to let me down?
Yeah, you're just here.
What are you possibly going to do that's going to let me down? Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
What have you got planned?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, or you need to, you know, walk me down the aisle, give a speech, and that's your lot. That's all you have to do. And he couldn't, and he was really stressed about it. I think when we got, you know, after the ceremony, he sort of relaxed. But I remember thinking, that's weird.
Yeah, that's
odd. So yeah, so he was diagnosed in 2011. Actually, during the time that he was diagnosed, he was making the last film that he was ever in, which was Snow White and the Huntsman.
Oh, wow.
And I learnt later on that Ray Winstone, bless his heart, had looked after Dad. He'd sort of recognised that
something
he wasn't
right.
Well.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because they'd known each other for a long time. And
he
was like, something's wrong with Bob. And he looked after him and made sure that he was okay, and then kept it very quiet.
Yeah, because that's not, as an actor, that's not what you...
No.
Sad, but true. Like, because especially actors who get to a certain age, it's like, to be able to be keep being employed, there needs to be that rumour that they're fine.
Exactly. But I mean, because he was diagnosed during the filming,
wow.
I think he kind of knew... This is the last one.
Yeah.
And that was really hard for him.
Just so painful. Yeah, because he must have worked, right?
Yeah. No, he was never out of work a day in his life.
Wow.
You know. I know, right?
Yeah.
So he was diagnosed then, and the diagnosis was that he would have like 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
Like tops.
Yeah.
He actually only had 3.
Wow.
And then in the summer 2012, he was re-diagnosed with straight Parkinson's.
Okay.
Which I was initially, like, really excited about.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, my God, you know, I might have him for another 10 years.
Yeah.
And then he was re-diagnosed again with PSP. Now, for some reason...
Oh, yeah, we've had other guests with PSP.
Yeah. Some reason I can't... Progressive... supernuclear palsy. I think I always have to really think really hard about it. It's like my brain doesn't want to remember that because that's what killed him.
Yeah.
And it's like my brain just won't hold on to it.
Mm.
So we had a few years. Oh, God, it was that really weird kind of horrible thing of grieving for someone who's still here.
Yeah. Well, they do say the moment you find out somebody has a terminal illness, the grieving process starts.
Yes.
Which I think is quite hard to get your head around if you haven't been through it, just because it's like, oh, what does that mean? But it's like something in you starts knowing they're dying, they're going to die.
Yeah,
part of your brain kind of switches and is like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Even though you, obviously when they do die, it's a whole other world.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to people who go, no, I've really prepared myself. I think I'm going to be fine. And you're like, yeah. It's quite different when they go, actually go. But there's definitely the process begins. So were you caring for him, or were you just sort of around a lot? Or
I was around a lot.
Yeah.
I was around a lot. That's why I quit my job at the magazine.
Right.
I paired everything right back so I could be around.
Yeah.
And at that time, we lived across the street from my mum and dad.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was great.
Yeah.
It was really good. I was really grateful for that because it just meant that I could just be there.
Yeah, just pop over and it not be like, okay, I have to get an hour train and get there. Like, I could just be there for 5 minutes then go.
Exactly,
but I've been there.
Exactly. And what Dad used to love doing was coming over to mine and hanging out. Aww. He would just hang out, he'd sit on the sofa and I would try and write while he watched Murder, She Wrote. It was really weird. When he got ill, he watched, like, I think those sort of like Murder, She Wrote and Columbo yeah. and Morse and all that. I think he found them like weirdly comforting. And I knew that he was poorly
yeah.
because he would not have tolerated like such poor acting. Do you know what I mean? He'd have been like, it's fucking shit, and turned it off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he just kind of, I don't know, sort of washed over him.
I think that's why they're on in the day, aren't they? Like yeah. for people who are sick or yeah. like tired, it's something very comforting about that sort of television. It yeah. just kind of, yeah, like you said, washes over
exactly.
you.
I think it just kind of, it was just sort of, I don't know, it was kind of like a warm bath or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, he'd sit and I'd make him endless cups of tea and I'd sort of try and write at the table, trying not to get distracted by the tinkling Murder, She Wrote theme tune and stuff. But I started writing a book about him not long after he was diagnosed, because I really wanted to kind of capture, like, he'd had this incredible life.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd done so much. And to me, the thought of losing those memories
yeah.
was really stressful and really painful, because I was like, no, they can't go.
Especially when someone, and I can imagine, I'm imagining, but that he was probably a very good storyteller.
Yes.
Off camera.
Very much so.
When someone's a real storyteller, you start realising, you know, the power of the storyteller,
yeah.
of like the story in their hands.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Is magic.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
my grandpa was like that. And then I always try and retell some of his stuff and I think, why is this not working?
This isn't landing.
Yeah, this isn't landing the way. But he was such a good, and especially stories of his childhood. So I'm sure, like, your dad must have had just.
Oh yeah, he yeah. had loads. Well, like when he left school, because he left school at like 14.
Yeah.
And he went and worked at the Covent Garden fruit and veg market.
Wow.
While it was still kind of not that far away from a sort of My Fair Lady.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of situation. And yeah, just hearing him talk about that, or hearing him talk about. He trained to be an accountant for 3 years.
Wow.
Yeah, he trained to be an accountant for 3 years before getting really bored and frustrated and throwing it all up in the air and going to Israel to live in a kibbutz.
Why not? Why
yeah.
not? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Issue.
Okay.
He had so many, like, interesting stories.
So were you able to, were you writing and asking him stuff?
Yeah.
And trying to, like, get it all down?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow. I was. I tried to, but what happened was, because those years before he died, when he was sick, was so difficult. I just felt like I couldn't.
Yeah.
It was just like remembering his past and like going back and watching the films and stuff
yeah.
while he was dying, and while remembering his life that he'd had, not just as an actor, but like all the things that he'd done and all like his way of being and,
yeah, yeah.
and watching him crumble little bit by little bit by little bit. And it was actually relatively rapid
yeah.
for one of those sort of illnesses. It was quite quick.
I guess it's just, that's the thing, is we say all the time, you know, oh, speak to people and ask them stuff, but I do understand that sometimes it's too fucking painful.
It was.
To be like, do you remember when you were great and brilliant and
yeah.
everything was brilliant? Like,
yeah.
It's painful.
It was like watching him in like The Long Good Friday.
Yeah, yeah.
And then going over to talk to him about it. And I was like, do you remember The Long Good Friday? And he was like, oh, no. And it was like, it was so,
yeah.
and I just thought, my time with him is limited.
Yeah.
So I can't keep upsetting myself.
Yeah, or being a biographer, I have to be a daughter, I guess.
Exactly,
and like
exactly.
Be there and
exactly,
be family.
Exactly,
yeah.
And I needed that emotional energy to be supportive to my mom
yeah.
and show dad as much love as I could. And in a, I mean, God, those years were, I don't tend to think about them that much because they
yeah.
were so painful, but I don't have any regrets.
Yeah.
Because I made time for him.
Yeah.
And I was there. And
it's all you can do, isn't it? It's like literally all you can do.
Exactly.
Is make sure you're, if you can be, obviously I know sometimes it's hard or the relationship's hard, but if you have an okay relationship and you can just be there as much as possible.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, talking about like relationships, another thing that I was grateful for was the fact that dad and I mean, it wasn't always easy.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't always perfect by a long stretch of the imagination. I mean, my dad was awesome. He was great. He was objectively awesome. He was really fun and really funny and very clever and very unique and extremely talented and massively generous and very interesting and very kind of mercurial. And he was difficult and he was tempestuous and he wasn't always that easy to be close to and he could be really unreasonable, but he was a once in a lifetime person. He just was. But Dad and I had had a tough time of it. But I think from my teens to my... But we had about 10 years where it was hard, where it was difficult, like maybe a bit longer than that, like 12. And it wasn't ever terrible, but it was just, it was quite strained. And
did he find it hard that you wanted to do acting as well?
No, he didn't find that hard. No, no. I think what he found was that, and I think a lot of dads go through this, like when I was a teenager, he didn't know how to relate to me. Because when I was little, we were best mates.
Right, yeah.
We were absolutely best mates. Like when I was born, I looked like a little rubber Bob Hoskins doll, do you know? And we just got along famously.
Yeah.
And we had this very, very strong bond. Mm. We were always very bonded. Even when our relationship was difficult, we still had this really... I don't entirely understand what it was or how it was, but we were just bonded.
Mm.
But it was difficult. And what we did, to my dad's great credit, was to go to therapy together.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because I've
How old are you when that happened?
24, 5.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Was it his suggestion?
No, it was mine.
Oh,
it was mine.
But he went with you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm very impressed.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, particularly for a man of like a working class.
Yeah, yeah,
North
his
London.
Generation.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's not generally the done thing.
No.
But I've been in therapy since I was 18.
Right.
Because I started exhibiting like signs of poor mental health pretty early on in various ways. So I was already in therapy and my therapist was like, look, it would do you a lot of good if your dad would come here and talk through these things with you.
Wow. And so did you just sort of say, do you want to come with me? And was he just like, yes? Or was there kind of a, did you have a difficulty to get him in the room? Or
no, not at all. He was really willing.
Wow.
He was really willing and he could see that I was suffering.
Yeah,
he could see that I was struggling. Like I had bulimia and I was self-harming and all things that I now recognise kind of fall under the umbrella of bipolar.
Yeah, yeah.
But I didn't, at the time, I didn't understand what was happening. I don't think he understood what was happening either. And he could see that I was suffering and he just wanted to make it better.
Of course, as a parent. Yeah, just whatever, do whatever.
Whatever you need, like I'll do it. So we went to it for a few sessions and there was this one, like, I think it was the first one. He obviously felt uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He felt really uncomfortable. And he kept going outside to check his car. He kept like we'd sit down. He'd sit down and the therapist was like, okay, well, we're here today because, oh, I'm just going to check the meter. And he'd go like bustling out. And I'd be sitting there like, oh, fuck's sake. And then a couple of minutes later, he'd come back in. He's like, right, okay, right.
I'm ready now, ready.
Yeah,
I'm ready.
Right. It's like, so Rosa wants to, oh, I'm just going to, and he kept going out and in.
Yeah.
And then when he came back, the therapist was like, what do you think you're doing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do you think you're doing? Like, you're here to talk to Rosa. Like, sit down and be, and like, I'd never, because he wasn't the sort of person that you would chastise.
Yes.
Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 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 no. Like, I can imagine, yeah.
Like, you could take, like, he could take criticism.
Yeah.
He could take criticism, but he wouldn't be told off.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he did. He was like, all right, fair enough.
Yeah.
And he sort of sat with it. And we had a few really, really good sessions. And it just really helped. It didn't make things perfect.
No,
but it
of course
just
not.
Really, really helped. And I think by the time he was diagnosed, we had already put a bunch of stuff to bed.
Yeah.
We were already done with loads and loads of stuff.
Mm.
And I'm really grateful for that because it just meant that I could just be there.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any, like, unspoken resentment. There wasn't any kind of, you know, oh, you said this and you undermined me here, or you were, you know, over demanding there or whatever. It was, okay, you're sick, I'm here for you, that's it.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really a credit to both of you.
Yeah.
That you had the, what's the word I'm looking for? Like the impetus, the want to make that relationship good. Because I think sometimes people, either two parties don't have the want, or they don't have the words, or they don't have the wherewithal to, how do we fix that? I think dads and daughters, it's like, it's so complicated.
It's so complicated.
In the way that I wish it wasn't. And I definitely, you know, that's what I've talked about a lot, like, because I was 15.
Yeah.
It's like we had a really complicated relationship that I totally can see would have been really difficult for some time, but like you said, would have got there eventually.
Yeah, well, it's like the satellite going around the moon.
Yeah,
It is like you're on the dark side and you will come out eventually.
Yeah, but definitely. And I've spoken to other people, like people, men with teenage daughters, and that, like, their look of confusion, like, but she's so mean. And you're like, yeah. It doesn't mean she doesn't love you or think you're brilliant or absolutely want you to be around. But of course she's telling you to your face, fuck off, I hate you. She's just saying. Like, I think it's really hard.
Yeah. Well, I remember a friend of mine, an actor friend of mine, is like, oh God, my teenage daughter hates me. I'm like, no, that's great. She's knocking you off your pedestal now.
Yeah.
Like, she's making you a human being now.
Yeah.
And like, you're going to be set up for a much easier, better relationship later on.
Yeah. You've got to do it. You have to literally like divorce your parents to become the human.
Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, it's really, wow, what an amazing, well, for both of you, I think that's amazing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I can't ever say this without really tearing up. But yeah, our relationship was just, by the time that he was really ill, it was just good.
Yeah.
And when he died, his last words to me, oh, fucking it's so hard to say.
I know.
His last words to me were, you're the most beautiful girl in the world and I love you so much.
We're both going to go. That's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
He really loved you. That's the thing I get when you talk about him, is how much he really, really loved you. And
yeah.
That's just...
No, we were lucky. We were lucky, and I do feel... And I've got friends who are kind of, like, they're in like, a long-running feud with one of their parents or, you know, they're not talking to their brother anymore, whatever it is. And I'm like, dude, you're going to regret that.
Mm. Yeah.
You really will. And I think that the upside to having a mental illness is that you kind of have to do a lot of work on yourself.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to do a lot of work on yourself to be, not to really improve yourself, just to be functional.
Yeah.
Just to be on a level that everyone else is on.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think that it makes you not as frightened to do things like therapy and to say, I think this would be really helpful if you came with me and did this.
Yeah,
And the fact that I've been in therapy since I was 18 years old, I think that it paved the way for Dad and I to have that closeness.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he was in hospital and when he was dying, like the moments before he died, because they say that the hearing is the last thing to go. I just sang to him.
Oh.
Just sang all his favourite songs, and I don't know. It's such a weird feeling, because on the one hand, I kind of feel like, why did it have to be him?
Yeah.
Like, really? He was great.
Yeah.
He was so awesome.
Yeah, and he was nice. He was real nice, guys.
Yeah, he was awesome. Yeah. He was nice and he was lovely. And one of the things that was a bit weird after he died was the amount of people who got in touch with me and said, like, makeup artists and directors and other actors, loads and loads of people from the business were like, oh, I worked with your dad here and he was great, or he was so generous, or he did this, or he did that. And I actually couldn't respond to any of those emails.
No.
It was just too much. And I had dozens of them. They kept coming in. And it was lovely to hear those stories And it kind of, and it confirmed who he was to me.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I think, oh, did I just, maybe I'm glorifying his memory, or maybe I'm making out like he was more than he was. But he wasn't. And all those other people, what they said about him, it just kind of attested to my memory. And the weirdest thing was that I wrote this blog post that went viral.
Mm.
And I wrote it when I was sitting in hospital with him in intensive care. And he was lying on the bed. I think he was asleep. And it was this really sunny day. And I just suddenly, all these things that he'd said to me over the years just came flooding back in this one sort of rush. And I have sort of like got out my phone and jabbed at the screen trying to write it all down. And the day after he died, there was lots of, obviously when it was announced in the press, there was a whole big thing, which was kind of surreal.
Oh God, I can't imagine, yeah.
It was surreal. But then I guess as well, I mean, it was surreal, but equally I didn't know any.
Yeah, that was his life. Yeah. So.
Mind you, I'd lost my grandparents and they, you know, there wasn't this massive press interest when they died. So I do know what it's like to lose both. But it was a bit weird. And it was when we turned on the TV, there was like the little ticker tape going, oh, Bob Hoskins has died. It was.
Or was it, because I remember Amy saying that suddenly seeing clips of him very healthy and from years before, you know, hosting or doing some article and she said she found one of the strange things she found of like at any point you can turn on the telly or radio and suddenly someone's decided that day to play a clip from something. You're like, whoa. Whereas obviously if I want to find a clip of my dad, I have to really work at it.
Really search for it.
Yeah, I have to really like find it. Whereas I guess you have that thing of like you can turn the telly on and you know.
Oh God, I mean, I can, you know, at the flick of a switch, he's
there.
So I wrote this. Yeah, so I got several phone calls from the press, and this one woman, I mean, she sounded a bit sheepish. I'm sure she knew that she was being evasive, but she was like, oh, I'm sorry to disturb you and I'm really sorry for your loss, but would you like to say anything about your dad? Would you like to comment about your dad? And I was like, if you were sorry for my loss, you wouldn't disturb me.
Yeah.
I put the phone down. But I wrote, I shared this list of 11 lessons. And it went viral. It was like, it was, my phone wouldn't stop beeping. It was like, I think it was seen like 100,000 times or something, or 200,000 times. It was a lot. And it was really weird, but also weird, kind of comforting.
Yeah, yeah. To spread that, like, to share that love that you had for him, I guess. To have that moment of like everybody being like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Which
is what you're looking for and need at that moment, and is also true, of course. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that it was not, because that list of points is, it's him.
Yeah.
You know, it's just him. Shall I read it? I've got it on my
phone. Yeah, please do. Yeah, I've read it before, but yeah. But please, I just, for the people who haven't seen it.
My darling dad has died. I loved him to the ends of the earth, and he loved me back just the same. These are the lessons he taught me. I will keep them close to my heart and remind myself of them whenever I stumble or falter. They are his words, the words spoke so often to encourage, comfort and reassure. This isn't general wisdom, rather advice that he tailor-made just for me. I love you, Dad. 1. Laugh. There's humour to be found everywhere. Even in your darkest days, there's something to have a joke about. Laugh long and laugh loud and make other people laugh. It's good for you. 2. Be yourself. If someone doesn't like you, they're either stupid, blind, or they've got bad taste. Accept who you are. You've got no one else to be. Don't try to change yourself. There's no point. Don't apologise. Don't make excuses. Be yourself. And if anyone else doesn't like it, they can fuck off. 3. Be flamboyant. It's who you are and always have been. Be eccentric and unique. Don't adapt yourself to someone else's view of normal. That belongs to them, not you. Like yourself as you are. 4. Don't worry about other people's opinions. Everyone's a critic, but ultimately what they say only matters if you let it. Don't believe your own press. People can just as easily sing your praises as they can tear you down. Don't waste your time on things you can't change. Let it slide off you like water off a duck's back. 5. Get angry. It's okay to lose your temper now and then. If anger stays in, it turns to poison and makes you bitter and sad. Get angry, say your piece, then let it go. 6. Whatever you do, always give it a good go. Don't be afraid of failure and disappointment. If you fall flat on your face, then get straight back up. You'll always regret not trying. Disappointment is temporary. Regret is forever. 7. Be generous and kind, because you can't take it with you. When you've got something to give, give it without hesitation. 8. Appreciate beauty. Take pictures and make memories. Capture it. You never know when it will be gone. 9. Don't take yourself too seriously. People who take themselves too seriously are boring. 10. Never, ever, ever, ever give up. Keep on punching no matter what you're up against. You're only defeated if you give up. So don't give up. 11. Love with all your heart. In the end, love is the only thing that matters. Yeah, that all went. That last one always kills me.
It's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's really, really, really beautiful.
That's what he was like. I don't know. That's the reason I sort of always keep it on my phone, because that's what he was like. The thing about being angry. Like, he was someone who... He did have a temper on him.
Mm.
And it could be quite frightening. But he would lose his shit in like a really spectacular way.
Yeah.
And then it was done.
Yeah.
It was over. And it would never be... It was really quick. And then it was done. It was over. And it would never be spoken about ever again.
Yeah.
And I find that's quite a rare quality.
Yeah.
And most people are passive aggressive, which I find really hard.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, my dad was aggressive. What we say in my family, aggressive aggressive.
Right.
And I'm aggressive aggressive.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
And I find it really... I find passive aggression so confusing, because I just... I don't know it's happening.
What I've come to realise is that most people are passive aggressive because they've grown up in environments where it's not safe to really say how they feel.
Yeah, definitely.
So they can't, like, that's the only method of expression that they have.
Yeah.
But like, Dad was like, when I was young, when he was loose, when he, and it wasn't often, it was only like 2 or 3 times a year or something that he'd really flip his lid. But when he... When I was young, it was scary.
Yeah, of course.
When I got older, it became quite funny.
Yeah.
Especially as I got taller than him.
Yeah, yeah. I was gonna say, you are a tall lady.
I know. I'm like 6 foot in my heels. And he, this little squat, angry man, going, it's like, all right, Dad. Calm yourself
calm
down.
Calm down, yeah. I'll be fine.
There was this one time when... when Dad was on the phone and he was on the landline in the kitchen, right? And we had this chrome, this round, like, chrome clock on the wall.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Directly above where Dad was standing. And he was talking to his American agent in LA. He was having, you know, talking business. And the clock fell on his head. And there was this perfect, like, skull-shaped mark in the frame of this clock. And he lost it. He was like, I can't fucking believe it. Fucking clothes, everything in this fucking house, always fucking... And he just went bananas. He dropped the phone on the floor.
Oh, my God.
And it's kind of dangling up and down. Yeah, yeah. And meantime, Fred is like, hello? Bob? And then again, it's like... Fireworks.
Yeah.
Done. And then he picks up the phone and he's like, sorry about that, Fred. The fucking clock fell on my head. What'd you say?
That's nice. It's nice.
It is nice.
Sometimes you're just really cross about something.
Yeah, exactly.
I always say that. I have to get it out. Like, if I will explode. I will internally explode if I don't spit this out.
Yes.
But I've learned to appreciate that it's hard for other people.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing.
I feel fine.
Yeah. No, exactly.
I feel a lot better.
Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
So the last few days, so then he went into a hospital.
Mm.
And so you were with him when he died.
Yeah. So he was in hospital for like two stints from February through to April. And he went in with pneumonia.
Wow.
And then he was there for like two or three weeks. He came out again. And then went back in some point in March. And then he was taken to the intensive care unit and then it was moved up and down basically in the same hospital.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were with him, my half-brother and my half-sister and my younger brother and my mum, we were all with him when he died. And it was so surreal because he... Like, technically, he was still in really good health.
Yeah.
Like, he was really strong. Like, his heart was fine, his lungs were fine, his blood pressure was fine. His brain was killing him. And it wasn't his brain that was killing him. It was the inability to move.
Yeah.
And that's a common thing for people who are with limited mobility, is that they get pneumonia. And yeah, it was because he still looked like strong.
Yeah.
He was sort of lying in bed and he didn't look feeble at all. He looked like he was going to get up and...
Yeah, that's really strange because when someone has cancer, they really, they look so... Yeah, they wither.
Yeah.
They're thin and they don't look well. They immediately, very obviously your brain is like, this person is not okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, it must have been so strange to still see a very strong, big body.
Yeah, exactly. And he was, I mean, he'd lost a lot of weight, obviously, but he was still, he's this stocky little powerhouse of a man.
Yeah.
But again, I'm just grateful.
Yeah.
I'm grateful that at the time I wasn't working.
And you could be there.
I could be there. Mm. And I'd turn down work and I was just like, no, I've got it.
Yeah.
Just be here. Oh, God. I mean, the day that he was taken into hospital, I had been diagnosed with bipolar by this point. But like, this is the definition of manic, I think.
Mm.
Like he was taken into hospital, first day of Fashion Week. I went with him to hospital, got ready in hospital, went to meet my colleagues. I fell over and broke my arm.
Oh, my God.
I smacked my elbow on the wet marble, which was great. And, yeah, I did this sort of big, like, Buster Keaton kind of fall in my outfit,
Fashion Week
outfit. And then, so, yeah, I went to do, I covered a couple of shows. And then I got on a cab and went over to Soho. I recorded a voiceover.
Wow.
Went back to Fashion Week, went to see a couple more shows, went to have a meeting. And then I went back to hospital to see my dad. And my friend who I was doing the voiceover for, he was like, you need to go to hospital.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm fine. He was like, dude,
go to hospital.
You need to go to hospital.
But it's so hard when you're on that treadmill. Mm. It's so hard to just, because when you get off the treadmill, what you're saying is this is happening.
Well, that's the thing. I realised after that.
Yeah.
That, I mean, I did the rest of Fashion Week with a broken arm, which was, I mean, I was sort of, I'd go from hospital to see a show,
wow,
go and write it up, go back to hospital. And I think after that, the next time that he went in, I was like, okay.
Yeah, I can't keep acting like this isn't happening.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You kind of, there gets to a point where you can't distract yourself anymore. Oh. You just have to accept that you are where you are.
Yeah, but I think it's so human to distract yourself. It's so human to be like, oh, this is a bit much.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and look at dresses and do my job.
Yeah.
And then that feels like for, and it's a thing like, for that brief second, it's not happening. But, you know, that 20-minute show, you're like, I'm normal, my dad's not sick, I'm just somebody doing their job.
I'm just a fashion journalist, and I'm just doing this.
And it just feels suddenly like, oh, this is peaceful.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you have to, the show finishes, time moves forward, and you're like, oh, shit, now I'm going to go back to what is actually happening. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think I'm grateful that I did make that decision.
Yeah, and definitely.
And I mean, there was still, I mean, it was such a hard time. It was such a hard time because you're in that sort of, I don't know if you had that with your dad, but you're in that weird twilight zone.
Oh, yeah. It's like you're not in the world.
No.
But everyone still acts like you are in the world.
Yeah.
You still have to get the tube, even though you're like, I shouldn't be doing normal things.
Yeah. And you kind of look around, you're like, hold on.
Yeah. How is anything functioning when my world is ending?
Stop. Like,
it's so, Twilight Zone's a good word for it because it is like you feel like you're like on a different plane of existence to everybody else. And I felt very far away. I felt like, you know, I'd be talking to people, but I felt like I was like in a end of a long corridor, 6 foot away.
Yeah.
But they were still acting like I was next to them. And I was like, no, I'm not here. I'm somewhere else.
Yeah.
Why are you asking me this bullshit about something else?
Like, how is this relevant to my life?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have the funeral quite soon afterwards?
Yeah, or? We did. It's such a weird thing to say, but it was a lovely funeral.
Yeah, there is such a thing as lovely funerals. And believe me, I've been to bad ones. And I would say, feel no guilt for having a lovely one. Because bad ones are
lovely.
Awful.
Yeah, like, oh God, yeah. No, it was really lovely. It was really lovely. And we had different sort of people from different parts of Dad's career. Mm. And I sang. And
what did you sing?
A Wolf Cry by Gregory Porter.
Oh.
And it was weird. I was like, I want to do this.
Mm.
I absolutely want to do it. And my mum was like, you're putting quite a lot of pressure on yourself. And I'm like, I don't care. Like, and it was, I had some sort of like compulsion to do it.
Yeah.
And my singing teacher, who's this gorgeous woman called Margot, she was like, you want to do it because you want to show people that your dad raised a strong girl.
Yeah.
That's why you want to do it. And I was like, yeah, you're right. But it was weird. It was so, I think my experience of grief for my dad was strange. A, in that he's famous.
Yeah.
And all the stuff that comes with that. But the fact that I also started writing a book and, I mean, I'd already had sort of started doing preliminary interviews with him and stuff, but, you know, I hadn't really made that much progress. And I wrote it with my friend Richard, and thank God I did, because I don't think I would have got through it.
Yeah.
Because it was the most foolhardy decision.
Yeah, it's hard when you're in the middle of the start of real grieving for someone to then try and, I always admire people who can put it on paper. I found it at that point impossible. I just was like, it's so, and somewhat a friend who's a writer once said to me, my God, why didn't you write it down? I was like, because to write it down meant it was happening. So I just, you know, watch Hollyoaks for 6 hours straight.
Absolutely.
I was like, I can't write this down. But yeah, so credit to you for doing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, because of that blog post that had gone viral, there was interest. And I'd wanted to do it anyway.
Mm.
So I was like, okay, well, now's the time.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But I think it did drive me a bit nuts.
Yeah.
It did drive me a bit nuts. And it was, and I mean, in some ways it was amazing and like a massive privilege because I got to go to like Judi Dench's house and Ray Winstone and like speak to Robert Zemeckis on the phone and, you know, I got to hear stories that I wouldn't have heard otherwise.
I was going to say, weirdly, that must have been perhaps that's what you kind of needed at that moment, to be around people who knew your dad, you know, a part of his life, which obviously was the thing with actors. It's like, it's not work, is it? It's who you are.
Yes, it's sort of
like a bit of you.
Yes.
And so to be around people who knew him so intimately and could talk to you, like, must have felt like being close to him again.
It did. It was like I could hang out with him.
Yeah.
And watching the films and stuff. Some of it was weird, like, because he did this TV series in the 70s called Pennies from Heaven.
Oh, yeah. Amazing.
That I'd never seen.
Because they never show Pennies from Heaven or the other one. It's the same guy, isn't it? Singing Detective.
Dennis Potter.
Yeah, they hardly... I had this conversation today. Like, it's weird that they never show them, but
Pennies from Heaven
is amazing.
Yeah.
And he's amazing in that.
He is phenomenal. I mean, he's my age
now in
it. And I'd never watched it when he was alive.
Wow.
So...
Yeah, it's quite intense.
Yeah, yeah.
I can see why you wouldn't pop it on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I just was like, okay, I need to do this. And I would just sit, I don't know, like, this is such a weird thing to say. I'm really scared of spiders.
Mm.
And if I see a spider, I have to hoover it up. So I stand like with trepidation, like, going, you can just hoover it up. You can get it. You can do it. You can do it. And eventually I'm like, okay, good.
Yeah, it's done. It's done.
And that was what I was like with the DVD player.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, put it in. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. Come on. You can do it. And then it took about 10 minutes of me.
It must have been, I can't imagine, because it must be so hard to see them younger, not only alive and well, but just younger and also not them, because they're acting, so it must have been such a strange experience,
a version, because he was 40 when I was born, so you know, like a version of him that I had nothing to do with. So it was weird. It was very weird, but I think I was just lucky. I was lucky that we had the relationship that we did. I was lucky that I got to write the book.
Yeah. How did you feel when you finished the book? Was there a bit of like...
Relief.
Oh, it was relief. That's it. It was like, oh, I have to stop talking about him.
No, because I knew that there'd be a bunch of press. I knew that, like...
He can still be a part of your life. Yeah.
But I mean, I do think that the book was... Yeah, it was foolhardy.
Yeah.
It was really foolhardy. And I mean, and I had post-traumatic stress as well. And sort of so trying to write the book about him, go and interview people, watch the recordings.
Yeah, it's like immersion therapy, isn't it? It's like most people be like, oh, my dad's died, and I need to process that. But you're like, he's died. I'm going to watch him, write about him, talk about him. Like, But I understand that. I understand that, obviously, doing the show. Like, some people say to me, why? Well, isn't it painful? It's like,
it is, but that doesn't mean
I don't want to do it.
Yeah,
like that's, you know.
But what I think a lot about the way mental health is spoken about, and I think this like when there's a kind of a narrative around a subject, it sets up an expectation, and I think that there's a kind of, there's a misunderstanding around grief in that it's considered something that you get over.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And with enough, and like you say, oh, it's been 5 years now, so I mean, you know, why are you still talking about it? Or why is it still upsetting you?
It's been 20, Cariad, why are you still upsetting you? Yeah,
because it's not something I'm going to get over. You know, it's just not something I'm going to get over. And I think that if you're kind of able to change that conversation, I think it's helpful, because then people aren't surprised when it's like, oh, this is still going.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, the thing I've started saying, which I don't know how helpful it is, but it's like, if somebody has a child, they don't say, oh, they're five, are you still talking about him?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I still have to look at pictures, or they're living with you?
Yeah.
Isn't it time? Like, having a child, and I know people are like, oh, well, children are vulnerable and different, but like, you have a child, it fundamentally changes who you are forever, you know. And if your parent dies, or, you know, any member of your family dies, it fundamentally changes a part of you forever.
Oh, yeah, it did. It changed. Like, I'm never going to be the same.
No.
I will never be. But you know what's interesting? I had a big falling out with one of my best friends, very sadly, 6 months after Dad died.
Wow.
Because the anniversary of his death fell bang on her wedding day. which was really unfortunate.
Yeah, really unfortunate.
And I found like the 6 month mark.
Oh, it's tough. It's tough.
One of the worst bits.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough.
Yeah.
I think for the first 6 months, you're in shock.
Exactly.
So you're not really processing a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
And then 6 months to a year, it's like a lot of stuff starts rising to the surface.
Yeah, you're like, ah!
Oh, and I've spoken to people 3 months in who are like, oh, I feel like, you know, I'm okay. And I'm like, no, you're in shock.
Yeah, you're just completely in shock.
You're not feeling anything yet.
And it was funny because I think it was a really good example of the misunderstanding that can happen when one of you is in the club and the other one isn't.
Yeah.
And she was expecting me go back to being the old Rosa.
Yeah.
And I was like,
you can't.
She's gone, hon. I'm sorry.
She's dead as well.
She's gone. Yeah. You know, you can't like, and I think there was a bit of like, well, come on.
Pull yourself together.
Let's be back to normal.
Yeah.
Or like, I need you to be like this. And it's like, oh,
I can't.
I've got nothing.
Yeah.
You know?
It's really hard, isn't it? Because I think people just don't. And it can, you know, someone at 6 months could be fine. Like, it's completely different. But if it's hit, if you're having a bad moment, day, week, hour, you've got nothing in the tank.
You've got nothing. Exactly.
And then, like, people are wanting, it's like someone saying, can you be a human? You're like, oh, I don't know how my legs work. I don't know how to stand.
Exactly.
Or make sounds out of words.
Exactly.
Like, without just, oh, I'm just going to bawl.
Yeah.
Or I'm just going to, like, dribble in a corner.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
well, what I said to her at the time, I was like, you being upset with me is as unreasonable as being upset with someone who's limping with a broken leg.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, I can't fix it.
Yeah.
Like, you can't fix it. You're broken inside.
Mm.
And especially when you've that first big grief, you know, like it's, your body's in so much shock.
Yeah,
and
so
just like
physical shock.
Physical pain.
Yeah.
And I think it is really hard for people to understand. If you haven't been through it, I can completely understand because I'm sure, you know, I'm sure before my dad died, I would have been like, oh, that's sad.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Do you know what? At the time, I was devastated. I was so upset.
Yeah.
And I thought, God, I've lost my best friend and my dad in the same year. But looking back on it now, I think she made some poor decisions. I think she handled it badly, but I get it.
Yeah, I understand. Oh, yeah, of course.
I do understand.
Yeah, and that's the thing of like, I never feel any like hate for people not in the club because I always just feel like it's just two paths that are very, very separate. And
yeah.
It's like, I totally understand why you're upset with me for being useless.
Mm.
And I've had that with, like, friends. I can see they think I'm a bit crap sometimes. It's like, I am crap, but it's because I, like, especially with mental health stuff, it's like, I'm crap, but I can't.
Mm.
I find it really hard to come out and see you. I find it really hard to go to that thing. And
and
I know it's so frustrating.
Yeah.
No, you just want to shake someone.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sort of make it go away.
No.
And when you are in deep grief, it's like you said, the world feels like 1,000 miles away.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and
yeah.
Anything joyous as well, like weddings and babies and graduations and celebrations. You're like,
it just feels like a bit of an insult.
Yeah, because you're alive and they're not.
Exactly. I went through this stage with that. Obviously, again, it's this weird thing with him being famous. But for a long time, I would see people who'd worked with him.
Wow.
On the covers of magazines or newspapers or posters or whatever. And I'd be mad.
Yeah.
Especially the ones like his sort of peer group.
Oh, God.
I'd be fuming. I'm like, what the fuck are you still here? Seriously? But then I'd get really, then I sort of realised I was getting really unreasonable when I was just getting angry with anyone who'd worked with him. So like I'd see like the cover of a magazine. I'm like, fuck you, Jennifer Lopez.
Yes.
It's like, no, she's in her 40s. It's reasonable that she's still alive. Do you know what I mean?
She didn't take his place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, you're just angry. You're just angry that it happened.
So angry.
And I think especially, it's interesting because, you know, like, I feel like that when I have friends and they'll say, you're like, oh, my dad's 70 this week. And I think, oh, 70.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
He got there.
Yeah,
you know, it never stops being a bit of a punch to the gut. I think you just get better at going, oh, congratulations.
Yay, happy birthday. Yeah. You sort of paint on a bit of a fake smile, don't you?
Yeah, but for the first few years, I definitely felt like, how comes no one else is going through this? And then what I've learned from doing the show is like, so many people are. So many people are going through it. You just, because it's not talked about, it's like, I guess what you're saying about mental health is you think, oh, it's just me. And then you're like, oh, actually, it's quite a lot of us.
I mean, God, no, I can really relate to the anger thing. I mean, Dad was 71 when he died, so it's not like he was young.
You know,
he wasn't like to die in your 70s is...
But it's still your dad. That's the thing, it doesn't take away the hurt and the anger.
Well, I feel like I should have had another 10 years with him.
Yeah.
I just feel like I've been robbed for 10 years.
You know?
And he should, like, I've got a little boy who looks just like him and he should be there. He should see that.
That is hard. The grandchildren thing, I think, opens up a new door.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the new pain I didn't even know was in this experience.
Oh, wow. Well, when Charlie was first born, like, he looked a spitting image of my dad. He even had little hairy shoulders. I was like, oh, God.
There he is.
Hey, Dad.
Do you find it a comfort now?
Yes. Kind of yes and no. I think all of it is bittersweet.
Yeah, yeah, it's very true. And it is never one or the other, is it?
No. And like I feel privileged. I feel like I've got a lot of privilege because of Dad and because of our relationship. But then also I'm really pissed off. I'm really livid, But it's interesting. I was talking to my doctor the other day, my psychiatrist, with regards to like mental health and grief and all these sorts of things. And I've recently decided to stop drinking because it would always, it was never helpful.
Yeah.
And I don't think I should have ever been a drinker. I mean, not that I'm a, am I a problem drinker? Kind of. Kind of.
Yeah.
I think if left to myself, yeah, I think so. And Dad, again, was he a problem drinker? Probably.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit.
Yeah.
Like, it's not always a little, somewhat out of control.
On the scale.
Yeah exactly. Yeah. It's definitely on the spectrum.
Yeah.
But my psychiatrist was saying, look, you have bipolar, okay? And what will be all right, for, like, someone else could drink the same as you.
Yeah.
And they'll be fine. Okay. And you're not, and you kind of have just got to accept it.
Yeah.
This is where you are.
Yeah.
And I think so much of the time we're fighting grief or mental health or whatever. We're desperately trying, going down to Fashion Week with a bloody broken arm. Like, you're kind of constantly...
I'm fine. Everything's fine.
Everything's fine. But it's not. And I think that if there is a bit of a more robust conversation around grief, around mental health, and we kind of make it so... In the same way that, it, you know, if you have a physical injury or whatever, you're in a wheelchair for the time being, hun.
Yeah.
You just are. And, like, you have to do your best with that. And I think, there have been times with my mental health. There are sort of quite often crossovers with my mental health and with grief. And there are times where, as much as I try and fight against it...
Mm.
I just have to accept that that's just
what's happening.
That's just where I am.
Yeah. I definitely have had that of like to stop fighting. To stop fighting. But I think so much of that fight comes from a want to survive, a want to be normal and healthy, which is really a useful survival, you know, that's why we're still standing. Because we like, you know, look when we cross the road and like don't smack our heads against brick walls for no reason. But then when something is wrong internally, it's very hard to go, well, I'm going to just act like I'm fine and be strong. And I've had that with grief of trying to go, it's just in you at the moment.
Yeah, and it's just where it is.
Is there.
Yeah.
And that's really hard.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think on the fight, I think that I quite often, I exercise a lot and I do like quite hardcore sort of HIIT cardio and stuff at home. And one of my friends was like, Rosie, you know, your exercise is so aggressive. And I'm like, yeah, because it's a fight.
Yeah.
It's a real fight. It's a real fight to sort of deal with my bipolar, deal with my grief. Like, I, you know, deal with the fact that there's this vast hole in my life where Dad should be. But it, with grief and mental health, they kind of, they're so sort of intertwined, because obviously one's grief does affect one's mental health. But like, I often have to have like a bit of a gauge as to where my mood is. So if I'm feeling depressed, I need to look at that.
Yeah.
And it might be that I need to change my meds around. If I'm grieving my dad, that doesn't need medicating.
Yeah, that just needs, you just got to go through it.
Yeah, exactly. I've just got to sit with that and just be like, and it's, so it's this constant sort of balancing act of like, well, where does bipolar begin and where do I end?
Yeah.
And what's grief and what's depression?
Yeah.
And what's mania and what's just feeling better?
Yeah, that's really hard. It's really hard because the grief is... And I've said this before, like the part of your brain that lights up when you're grieving is the same part that lights up when you're depressed.
Yeah.
Like, so just chemically, that's why when you're, and obviously grief is not a mental illness, but it's why you feel isolated and alone and depressed and sad and all of those things that you feel when you're down.
Yeah.
And it is really hard to just go, and I guess if, I mean, who is this person? But I guess if you're like person A who is completely normal and has no mental health, you can just be like, oh, I felt fine before and now I am grieving and now I'm not grieving. But I don't think many people exist. I think we all have such messy internal lives.
And I think everyone's on a spectrum.
Yeah.
Of mental, and also I think that poor, and this is why I talk about it so frequently, like poor mental health is something that can and will affect everyone. Like, you don't have to have bipolar or borderline personality disorder or whatever to experience, you know, if you're really stressed at work, then you're going to go through mental health stuff. You know, if you're really, if you're dealing with grief, you know, that the grief can tip over into, like, so for example, you know, you could be drinking your way through it, understandable, I did to a certain extent. And that tips over into something else.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important that to be aware of these things. God, there have been times when I've felt like demented with grief. I felt like it sort of drives you, you are like maddened by it.
Yeah. Well, I think the phrase grief stricken, you start to really understand why that is a word.
because
someone is literally struck with grief. They can't think or do anything else. And you do feel mad. You do feel... so like angry and crazy and all of those things it's such a, but I think it's a credit to you that you are so aware of your mental health and have been able to process this while holding the hands of your own mental health, like and balance those things, because it's not an easy journey anyway without
a mental
health thing to be dealing with as well.
No, it's not. No, it's hard. And it's, you know, there have been times when it's been really, really, really tough.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I spent a little time in a psychiatric unit a few years ago. And I think what had triggered that depressive episode had been just this massive amount of grief.
Yeah.
This absolutely massive amount of grief. I guess, I mean, I haven't spoken about that publicly at all, but I think I've sort of decided that I will, because I want people to know that, you know, yes, if you're hospitalised with your mental health, it's really serious and it's a really big deal. But it'll be okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
It will be okay.
I guess that's it. It's still the language of not talking, and it's like, whispered of like, oh, I think she's gone into hospital. People are still so panicked about it.
So panicked. I was panicked about it. On the way down there, I was like, Jesus Christ. I mean, I can't believe it's come to this.
Yeah.
You know, my God.
I completely understand, because I know what grief has done to me.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't have bipolar. I have mental health issues like we all do. But And I think it's so hard, isn't it? Because you want to talk about grief so much, and you don't want people to be afraid of it, but you all each want to go like, it's a really big thing, and it can hugely affect your life in massive, massive ways. And that's okay, because you really, really loved that person.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like you said, when you talk about that hole in your life, I completely understand that. And that's not something you get over. That's not something that will go away. Like, he obviously loved you so much, and you loved him so much. It sounds like such a really lovely relationship.
Mm.
That's going to take time for you to build a life around that hole.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it was kind of, he was such a sort of linchpin.
Yeah.
Dad had this energy that was like, he was really funny and he was really avuncular and quite loquacious and jolly and all this. But he also had like a bit of, don't fuck with me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, we're going to get on great, if you fuck with me, there are going to be problems.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter who you are.
I don't give a shit.
I'll be giving you problems.
Yeah, yeah. And not in an aggressive way.
No.
Not in an angry way, but I think he just had this...
He had a lot of high status about him.
Yeah, he did. Because he didn't care.
Yeah.
He was like, I don't care who you are.
Yeah. Well, Rosa, thank you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Talk to us about Bob, who we all know and love anyway. But it was really nice to hear him as a dad.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Rose's book is available to buy now. It's called It's All Going Wonderfully Well, Growing Up with Bob Hoskins, and is available to buy from all good bookshops. You can head to Rose's website, rosahoskins.com, where you can read her blog, a brilliant, lovely blog about fashion and mental health and all sorts of things. You can follow us on Twitter and the Instagram as well at TheGriefCast, or you can email thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.